What's up, Knife Freaks, Sharpness Geeks, and purveyors of stabby goodness? Welcome to the Knife Freak Show. My name is Jonathan McNeese. This is my co-host, Mr. Chase Boatwright.
Greetings.
So, just so you guys know, a little technical note here. You guys have heard us talk about how we have to record without being able to see each other to get this thing to work. Well, apparently the software that we've been using has changed things up, and that's no longer an option. And so we can actually see each other now. So maybe we can make this thing go a little bit smoother. And let's hope that maybe the software has been upgraded to the point that it actually works and it doesn't screw us over. So we'll see. So,
yeah, I don't know if we've talked about it on here before, but it's really hard to have like a lot of these conversations where you can't see the visual cues or even, you know, do what we just did and like where I like, you know, sort of did that. You're kind of just sitting in silence and, you know, hoping the other volume doesn't kick in and try not to talk over each other. But yeah,
it definitely makes it a lot harder when you're not getting those visual cues and stuff of being able to tell if the other person's about to say something or kind of tell when they stop talking or whatever. Not to mention all the show and tell stuff. We always miss, you know, we don't get to see what the other person's talking about in real time. So maybe this is going to work. We'll see. So, if it does and you're hearing this and watching this, then great. If not, then we may be talking to ourselves and you'll never see or hear it. So we'll see what happens. So how's your week in the shop, Ben?
Last week, I don't even know what I did last week, to be honest. I did something. I worked on some stuff. I don't even remember now. What did I do? I don't know. I worked on some stuff and did some stuff. I vacuumed my shop because, one thing, I got a new vacuum in. That's exciting. I killed my other shop vac after, I don't know, I think I got it in 2015. So had a 10-year run, and I've sucked up a lot.
Way better than I've ever done.
Stuff. Yeah, I mean, I bought it in college because we flooded the college apartment, and we needed to be able to, we have a wet vac, and like literally we would suck up a gallon or, you know, five or whatever it holds and go dump it out and suck it up and go dump it out. So yeah, that's why I originally bought it. It just made the transition into knife making.
Yeah. That reminds me, this would have been a conversation to have before you bought this one, but, we bought a new shop vac actually not long ago either. You know, we're running that little, desktop mini mill to run G10 and my Carta and stuff in. And that's something I actually need to show a video on, speaking of that, so you guys that are listening can see what we're talking about. I'll try to get that posted up on Instagram here and maybe YouTube as well pretty soon. It's a really cool little machine. But anyway, it has a built-in vacuum, but it sucks. Ha, pun intended. And so it also has where you can you can switch it to an external vacuum and like plug the vacuum into the back of it. So it, and switch it so that the internal vacuum is not what's doing it. So, that thing is, and the normal shop vacs, of course, it would work great, except it's loud and it's already loud enough in the shop, but a shop vac running, that thing would keep it running, on a good day, it's running most of the day. Ideally, we're supposed to be running it nearly all day, every day. And so that's highly annoying. And, so anyway, did some research, found a shop vac that's super quiet. Like you'd almost wonder if that's not even coming on when you turn it on. Like it's got some noise, but it's the most impressive, you know, as far as being quiet of anything that I've seen. And I do not even remember the brand or anything off the top of my head, but I'll get back with you on that. I just know I found one. I can't remember. I don't remember. I'm afraid to even say what brand it was. I'll find out though. And I'll report back next week. But yeah,
sounds good.
Really nice to have.
Yeah. I was just going to say a good shop vac is like an underrated, undervalued, you know, that's very important in a knife shop. Like,
Yeah. And if you're doing it for something like we're doing, where you're doing like dust collection while you're working and you're not just using it for like cleanup or whatever, it's the quietness is huge because they are extremely loud typically. So yeah, that's cool. I'll try to remember and do an update on that next week, but that's cool. And do a little update on the other Instagram and YouTube on the little mini mill. But, well, that's cool. So got some stuff done, got upgraded the shop vac, or repaired the shop vac. So sounds like you had a pretty decent week. Yeah. And actually, it just now occurred to me, I remembered it. We're recording this late, guys, because I was out of town this past weekend when we normally record. So it's the timing's a little off. We apologize, but we're going to at least get one in. It's just going to be a couple of days late.
Yeah, definitely. And so how that, I think that's why I can't remember what I did, because I've already, you know, worked a couple of days since then. So I don't know already, what I did last week. But how was your week in the shop this week or last week? Just tell us stuff.
Yeah. Good. It was good. We, this week so far, it's going good. Last week went well. I was actually in the shop up until, on Thursday, you know, we do, I say it a lot, I know, but we do Monday through Thursday. Typically we do 4-10s. And so Thursday, I came out here and kind of checked on things and then took off to go out of town. So, but the guys held it down. We actually, you know, we have a goal of how many knives to build per day. And, and then obviously that adds up to a weekly goal. So for the first time in a while, we actually hit our weekly goal last week. And so far we've hit it both days this week. So I'm extremely happy about how well that's going. Sweet. And feel like we'll hit it tomorrow. And then of course it'll only be 3 days this week because we'll be off for Thanksgiving. It's hard to complain about that. Let's see. We've got the new used machine is basically up and running. We just got finished hooking up the Pearson pallet systems and stuff in there today. Got the airline hooked to them, all that. We've just been kind of piecing things together. You would think after this many machines, I would remember everything that we need to get and do to hook one up and get it up and running, but I keep forgetting stuff. So, it's got to have air run to it. Oh yeah, we got to have air split off to go to the Pearson pallet. We're going to start making pallets on it tomorrow, and should be before the end of the day tomorrow, we should be making fixed blades on it or doing that, doing the profiling and the things that we do on the fixed blades on them. That's super exciting. I'm super happy to be able to finally start doing fixed blades more consistently. That's something that's been a good 2 or 3 years in the making here that I've been struggling and trying to do. So,
That's all you can do is one day at a time and plug away.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't, without sacrificing something else.
Yeah. I think I know the answer to this, but you're on the new machine, you're not grinding the blades. That's still just the one machine you have set up for that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. We got one machine for that. And honestly, that'll be our next bottleneck. We'll be having time to grind enough blades. So there's a couple of things we can do to probably speed it up a little bit. We're still, we got started with this new process and it's working. So when something starts working, I'm always very hesitant to, even if it's not the most efficient, I'm like, okay, don't breathe on it. Like, don't change anything. Do it exactly the same way. I don't care if it's not as efficient, but I think we're about to the point where we can do a couple of things where we can make it at least a little bit more efficient to where we can run more blades, like at least run a few, like as when we leave, set it to run a few. Right now, it basically, somebody has to reload a blade every 6 minutes or so. So that's not super efficient. The amount of time it will take to run the blade won't really change. But if we can load it up to run 6, 5, 6, 10 blades at a time, then, if you set that to run as we leave the shop and then maybe I reload it and run it again before I go to bed, like I typically do with everything else, that sneaks in quite a few extra grinds before the day's over with. So,
Not to mention man hours of, person standing at machine and, waiting on, for a couple minutes. I mean, watching, waiting, but still it's 6 minutes. That's someone's just standing there.
To be honest, there's don't really have a whole lot of time. There's not much of the watching and waiting that goes on. I'm kind of a stickler on, having very little wasted time in the shop. So they're typically,
I know that, but there's also not a whole lot of time to do much else in 6 minutes. I mean, you could be taking other stuff off pallets and doing some small stuff, but there
you'd be surprised. You can't
go. I mean, but there's things you can do. There's always things to do.
Yeah, we have the guy particularly that does it on the weekend. that runs its own. He's able to get a good bit of. He just basically sets a 6-minute timer on his phone, and as soon as it starts, he goes over there, starts processing handles, you know, deburring stuff or whatever. And it's to yeah. me, it would be highly annoying the way I like to work to have to interrupt it every 6 minutes. But it's you do that, you know, constantly. It's 6 minutes at a time. You can chip away at a good bit of work if you, you know, it'd be different if it was like, you know, we were in a huge shop and it was way on the other side or whatever, and half your time was spent walking back and forth to the machine. But we're talking a few steps, so it's it works pretty well, but it could definitely be more efficient. So, but that'll the next purchase probably will be an actual 5-axis machine. You know, this is, I know you know, but so everybody knows, this is a 3-axis machine that we put a trunnion on, so to give it 5-axis capability. And the next one, we'll probably just buy a small 5-axis machine to up our grinding capacity. So I figure probably first quarter or so of next year, we'll be hitting that. So we shall see.
That's awesome. Yeah. Good. Glad things are moving well for you going up, and more machines on the horizon, it sounds like. I did want to mention two things on the note of last episode in where we had our sort of handle discussion and my blew my Carta rant that a lot of people thought was funny, apparently. Got some messages over the week, and people were asking for blew my Carta, and I had to, quietly as I could, tell them no. But anyway, first thing on the blew my Carta is not all blew my Carta is bad. I've used some good blew my Carta. It was just this particular blew my Carta that I had this much issue with. I've had some other blew my Carta that worked fine, but it was inconsistent in color. I've had some that was perfectly fine working, perfectly good in color, etc. Like, so didn't want that to, I just kind of started thinking in my head that people may have the wrong impression on that. Other thing is one of our listeners reached out and wanted to ask our opinions on the new glass composites that have been coming out, particularly from Fat Carbon and from Morphaholic. And for those that don't know, Morphaholic is, I think he's some sort of engineer. He's on Instagram. That's his, like, it's at Morphaholic is his name. And I don't know how he's producing all of these materials or what, but he's producing a whole bunch of cool materials, particularly these glass composites, and he's doing some carbon fibers and stuff with, like, really crazy bright, vibrant colors. But from my understanding, the glass, they just call it glass and like, or glass composite. And it looks like just a bunch of shards of glass or fiberglass that are just like stuck all in there, not necessarily uniform like G10 in a sheet. And so, and in my experience, which is very limited, I've only worked with, I think two knives. I'm not even confident about the second knife. I can't remember. It works like G10. It's machines well. It grinds well. It cuts well. But it has a very cool look to it. I like it better than G10 due to the visual contrast, I guess, you get when you grind into it. It, you know, has that more like a micarta type of, you know, contrast, or like a rag micarta type of contrast, where you get all this different randomness, but it's still kind of uniform. Because all those different fibers are not necessarily all set in there at the same angle or, you know, whatever. It's sort of like that shred carbon fiber type stuff in a lot of ways. But, so that was, I guess, a big reason we didn't talk about it last week, is I have very little experience, and I don't think you have any experience, do you?
No, I haven't used any at all. So I can't give any feedback on that, unfortunately, but it sounds interesting.
It's interesting stuff. I mean, for a while, it was just the Westinghouse stuff. Apparently, Westinghouse made it originally back in the day. And when a material is, you know, even when it gets above like $100 for just a set of scales for one knife, I'm probably out. That's just me. I'm cheap like that, I guess. But I'm not, you know, I don't see putting, you know, $500 scales on a knife. I just can't bring myself to do it. Even if the return, you know, will be there when I sell the knife, it's not that, you know, that's not the point. The point is, you know, the general outlay of it. when, you know, I'm purchasing the material. Cash flow is generally the key thing, because I could buy, I don't even know how many sheets of micarta and G10 and Rich Lot for $500. Like, I don't even know how many I could buy, but it would be a lot. So that's sort of just where I stand, is I don't mess with a whole lot of really high end, you know, rare stuff. Some of the glass that like Fat Carbon and Morphaholic have been coming out with, that's like $50, like a set of scales of carbon fiber or Fat Carbon. So, I mean, it's nothing too outrageous.
Cool. I'll have to look at that, because I'm completely behind the curve on it. I haven't even come on my radar. So I'll check that out. But that's interesting. So
yeah, it's definitely cool when it gets really good, like solid, consistent color, much like G10 does, I think, due to that fiberglass epoxy process, whatever it may be. All right.
Cool. Definitely worth checking out.
Yeah. Next thing we wanted to go into was, we had a question last week on YouTube, and it was from Bernie Blades. And he said, starting out, what is a good, somewhat consistent method for heat treating? And he went on to talk about how he, you know, used a torch and some canola oil and, you know, that whole thing that I think a lot of us did when we first, you know, started out. I don't even think I used canola oil. I used motor oil and a little like pan. It was like a little metal pan that I found. And so, what would be your thoughts? What would, on that?
So let me ask you this. Did you use just a torch, or did you build like a little forge kind of thing? Or did you just straight heat the edge and then quench it?
When I first started, it was probably just a torch, and tried that a couple times, but then I found out that I was using 1018 mild steel, which is basically non-heat treatable, which I later found out, because, you know, dumb.
And did the same thing.
I just knew the 10 series was supposed to be really easy, and people kept saying like 1084 and 1075 are really easy, but 1095 is hard. So I just went way on the other way. I was like, okay, the higher you go, the harder it is. I'll just go way down here, and, you know, I can't screw this up. Well, I still screwed it up. But I think I was just using.
I'm laughing because I basically did the same thing. So,
yeah, I mean, I was just using a torch, and I tossed it into the pan of oil. I didn't hold on to it. I just dropped it. That thing's hot.
That's funny. I think my first couple of, honestly, I wouldn't even call them real attempts. It's kind of like you. Like, I had, at that point, I didn't even understand the difference between, I didn't even research it to know, like, the 10 series steel or whatever. Like, I just, it was some steel, and, you know, steel is steel, and I heated it up with a little torch and tried to heat treat it, you know, tried to dunk it in motor oil or something. I don't remember. But then moving on to like the next successful heat treating though. So what I did, and I actually went, I didn't read enough or didn't know enough to think that 1095 was difficult. And I kind of dove into it pretty quickly. With partly too, because my goal pretty much right off the bat was to do Hamones, and W2 was not readily available in bar stock back then. And so that was kind of my option. So I just dove into 1095 pretty much right off the bat. And what I did is I bought some fire bricks. I'm someplace online. I can't remember. And actually the first ones I bought were the wrong kind. There's two kinds of fire bricks. And I don't know the official names of them, but there's one kind that's like very solid, more like an actual like kind of brick, like it's very dense and solid. And they weren't thick as thick as a brick. They're like 1 inch thick and probably like 4 inches by 8 inches, something like that. Those will help to, like, if you want to put them on a surface, like to keep whatever's underneath, protect whatever is underneath it from the heat, they do a pretty good job of that, but they don't like reflect the heat or like contain the heat the way you want to with the other ones. Plus you can't carve in them because the other ones are very porous. They're extremely light. They are in the shape of like a thick, probably a little thicker than normal. They're about the size of an average brick, maybe a little bit bigger, I guess. The ones that I got, they may come in different sizes. I don't know.
Yeah,
but they're more like a white looking material.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they are a little bit bigger, and they're like a white material. It's very coarse looking. And it's actually pretty soft. Like you could take like a nail or something and like scrape and like dig into it, like make a hole in it or whatever. Like, they're very soft. And so what I ended up doing was I bought a few of those and I stacked them up and basically created a little cubby, like a little forge essentially. And I drilled or bored a hole. I don't remember how I did it, whatever, but carefully because they will crack pretty easy too, because they're so porous and they're a little bit crumbly if you're not careful. So I managed to get a hole through the center of one, and it was on one side of the forge. And I just took my little torch and just a regular propane torch, like the little, I don't remember I may have tried it with the ones that screw straight on the bottle first. I can't remember, but pretty quickly I found the attachment that's like a hose that goes to the torch head, and then you screw the one end on the bottle, and then it's got a hose that goes to it, so you're not stuck with the torch head attached to the nozzle. Is not attached directly to the bottle. There's a hose in between. And so then I would take that and I'd stick the nozzle of the hose most of the way through that hole, basically almost flush with the inside of the hole. And so there's no door, but it's just an opening. So it's, a little cave with no door, and that was sticking through the side. And so then I would just hold the knife and the blade, and I would move it back and forth on the flame. The flame would kind of circulate in there, and the whole inside would heat up some, but of course it was still way hotter right where the flame was coming through. So I would kind of keep the blade moving to try to keep the heat as even as possible. Now, of course, I was not keeping it perfectly evenly heated, but I tried to keep it as evenly heated as possible. And then I kept one of those little extendable magnets that you use for like picking stuff up from behind stuff. You know what I mean? Like people using garages and stuff. I kept one of those handy, and I would work it back and forth in there. And after you'd done it a few times, you kind of learn the color that it would change, the color of orange, just the right color before it gets too bright orange or whatever. And you'd know when to start checking it. Yeah. And I'd check and make sure that it was non-magnetic. Then I actually had some, instead of used motor, I just didn't have any used motor oil on hand. I went down to a Dollar General and bought some, it was actually synthetic. What was it? It wasn't motor oil. I think it was transmission fluid. I want to say it was synthetic transmission fluid. I don't think it was actual motor oil. I could be wrong. That's been quite a while ago. So I think it was synthetic transmission fluid. And I had like baking pot or whatever.
Yeah. I think Don Fogg or somebody like that had a mixture of their quench oil was something involving transmission fluid or transmission oil or something like that.
That may be where I've got it. Because back then I read all kinds of whatever I could find on the stuff. That might be where I got the idea. Said mine wasn't a mixture. Yeah. It was just straight up Dollar General transmission fluid. Now later on I did move to Parks 50. Once I was able to, had a little more money to spend and I could, and I found a source for it, because it took me a while to find a source to be able to get it. I think it was harder to get back then, or at least it seemed like it. It may have just been that I didn't know where to look.
No, it was.
So basically I would do, I don't think I ever threw one in there like you did, but I would basically, like I said, I would heat it up, get it up to temperature, check to see if it was magnetic. And as soon as the whole blade was not magnetic, I'd pull it out and I would dunk it in my Dollar General transmission fluid, and, learned quite a bit, probably didn't do it initially, but I learned that you need to keep it moving when you quench it, because bubbles will form around it, and which will actually, this is very interesting, and a lot of people probably don't know this, because I certainly didn't. When you put it in that hot oil, so the number one, the whole reason that you're putting it in a quench is to take it from its critical temperature, which for specifically the, like 1095, those simple steels like that, is basically around the temperature that it goes non-magnetic. And so that's its critical temperature. You take it from that, and with 1095, you've got like, I think it has to go from like the critical temperature down to less than like 400 and something degrees, 500 somewhere in there. I can't remember, within like a second. So it has to cool from that temperature, which the, I think the critical temperature on it's like what, 1450 or somewhere in there.
1475 is what we always did.
Okay. I'm actually pretty proud I got that close after this long, but, so you'd go in from that down to like 400 or 500 degrees within a matter of a second. So it's got to go quick, right? So then that's where the using the proper fluid helps. And the transmission fluid worked pretty well. So anyway, back to what I was saying, we quench it and it's going to create bubbles around it. Just like when you put something hot in fluid, in water or whatever, it's going to make it boil around it, right? And so those bubbles, air bubbles, would mm-hmm. stick to the surface of the metal, and those actually create an insulating layer, and they will actually let it, wherever those bubbles are, it will hold the heat in there. And what you're wanting to do is to make it get cool really, really quick. And so you don't want those bubbles to form and stick to, they're going to form, but you don't want them to stick to the blade. So you keep it moving while you do it. When you keep it moving, you want to move it vertical, or not vertically, but not laterally. What's the, straight
don't,
forward,
don't go
like in line. Don't go laterally. Yeah. Like basically like you're trying to saw the fluid, like cut it like with the edge of the knife. You do not want to move it back and forth, because as that blade is cooling off, it's very prone to warping and stuff. Like the force of it pushing against that fluid can actually cause it to warp one way or the other as you're pushing it. I'm on a whole, like, it's been so long since I did this and really thought about it, I'm on like a whole excited rant now. But another thing I learned on that note, after this took me a while to learn with a bunch of warped blades, and this is going to sound crazy to a lot of people, but it actually makes a difference. So when you do quench it, you also want to have your setup set up so that you are facing due north. All right. Then you want to make sure that the moon is at 12 o'clock. I'm just kidding. Not that part, but you do want to be facing due north. And the reason for that is, like I said, that knife is, you take it to the point that it's non-magnetic, right? When it quenches and it gets down past that critical temperature, it's going to become magnetic again. And that amount of time when it goes magnetic again, the pull of the North Pole can actually cause that blade to pull in that direction. Because when I first started doing it, my blades would always warp to the same side every time. And this is it's more noticeable, of course, on longer blades and stuff.
Yeah.
I was like, what? Like, why is it warping the same, like, and why is it going the same direction every time? You know, because it stands to reason that it should be random, maybe, or whatever, but not when you include the magnetic pole. It was pulling, and as soon as I turned and I started quenching in a different direction, quenching facing north, so then I'm moving the blade in a straight line that direction, like, they still warp some, but it drastically changed the amount of warping and the always being in the same direction that I had. So that's another little tidbit that's very, I always found super interesting and sounds like some kind of like old wives tale, but it, from my experience, is 100% true. So
yeah.
Did you ever, I know I told you about that, but did you ever get to see that for yourself with it doing it the wrong way?
Yeah, whenever I moved into my new shop and got my heat treat oven set up, I was basically facing east, and I was having that issue. All of them were pulling north. They were going to the left.
Yep.
And
yep.
I left my heat treat oven where it was for a little while. I just, instead of quenching this way, I quenched and turned and faced north and quenched that way, and it helped.
Sure.
I never did as much 1095 as you. I don't think, or, oil quench and anything like that.
Yeah.
But back to, you said like on your original, like, what you consider your first knife, the tossing it in the motor oil was not necessarily what I consider my first knife. That was my first knife-like object.
You're right.
But the first time I actually got a heat treat right, it was, in a forge. My stepdad was obsessed with forging in fire at the time, and so he had went and bought a forge, and he knew I wanted to make knives, so he was like, here, you can use a forge and make knives and do whatever you want. And I was like, I can use it for heat treat. I don't really want to forge, even though I did try. I did try to forge for a little while just because I was like, well, maybe this will be easier. And I was like, no, it's not easier. it's way harder, especially without power hammers and any sort of mechanical equipment. No, trying to make I had some square 01 and just trying to get it somewhat flat. That bar is still basically a square to this day. And, but anyway, so I had a forge. They're not that expensive. A Farrier forge off Amazon. I think when he got his, and this was 2016 or something like that, it was $400 or something. I imagine they're pretty cheap. Pretty accessible these days compared to a heat treat oven, which is generally at least $1,300, if not up. And that's on sort of the lower end for like really small ones. And usually like that's what you'll find them like a used price. Like I've got an old Paragon that's basically big enough for folder blades, and I got it for pretty cheap. But my Even Heat, I think, cost $2,200 or something like that. And so,
right.
Excuse me. But yeah, a forge, if you're doing carbon steels, will work. Using all those methods that, Jonathan outlined, doing the non-magnetic. And like he said, you'll learn sort of that color of orange. And I think my first real quenchant was used French fry oil from my dad's side of the family has a concession stand for the business that they were in at the time. They had a drive-in movie theater. And so I just, they were pouring out old, French fry oil and chicken finger oil and stuff. And so I was like, hey, can I just have that? And I don't care. So yeah, it smelled like French fries and chicken fingers in the shop for a little while. But
I was about to say either yours smelled way better than mine did, or way worse. I figured it could go either way. So,
burnt transmission fluid is not a good smell. I've smelled it.
It's not pleasant. It's not,
no, it. I don't know what's in there, but nothing can be good. Nothing about it could be good to breathe. But yeah,
no.
So that would probably be my recommendation for you, Bernie Blades, is to if you're not ready to jump into a full-on kiln at this point, look online and see if you can find an affordable forge, a propane forge type setup. And you can heat treat blades that way. It may not be the optimal, perfect, in a vacuum heat treat, but it is possible. And my other recommendation would be, don't be afraid to send it to Peter's Heat Treat or one of these other heat treating houses. You don't have to heat treat it yourself. I know it costs more money and all that, but if you're worried about having the, most optimum heat treat, this is advice that I'm talking to myself about. Cause I still struggle to actually send stuff away and, let my hands not be in control of it. But, I struggle with doing water jet. I struggle with sending stuff to heat treat and stuff like that. So anytime it leaves my possession, it makes me nervous. But don't be afraid to, use one of those services if you're not confident in your heat treat.
Yeah, I would second that. It's, some people just, want to do it themselves. And some people just also don't have the budget to do it, especially if they're doing it as a hobby. They may not have the budget to do it. And speaking of the budget, what, even though I was laughing about it and my little makeshift forge thing was pretty janky, but I heat treated a bunch of knives and a bunch of knives that performed really well, out of that thing. Now, I did not have a hardness tester at the time, but if you go way back on my YouTube channel, you can see some videos of knives that I used that I heat treated like that, where I used to make, I may have had an oven by the time I started the choppers. I can't remember. I feel like the first few I did in that little makeshift forge, I can't remember. But had a video where I was hammering one through the lid of a old washing machine, a dryer, the top of an old dryer. I did, all kinds of,
Nothing.
Yeah. It was pretty crazy. But I did a bunch of real world testing with them and chopping, some really hard firewood, stuff like that, chopping on oak and dried out oak and stuff like that with them. And they held up really well. So, was it textbook, you know, way to heat treat? No, not at all. But they, you know, they worked really well. So it might take you a little bit of trial and error, but yeah, if you're on a for real shoestring budget, you can always do that. And I have no idea how much those fire bricks cost now, but I would guess you could probably get that whole setup, torch and propane and bricks and everything, and some used, you know, or some, even if you go like I did to the Dollar General and buy some transmission fluid, you could probably get that whole setup for under $100. So
yeah,
it's, you know, it's, you can always do that and get yourself started. And then if you're doing it as a hobby, and you know, you can do that and then upgrade when you're able, or if you're doing it as a business, you know, to sell them, then you do something like that, you know, test them, make sure that the quality is good, and then sell them. And once you got enough money to reinvest back into a better setup, you reinvest into a better setup. That's exactly what I did. So it's certainly doable.
Yep. Yeah. And that's sort of how everything sort of works. I mean, like, you know, I started on a 6x48 grinder that was given to me. 6x48 belt sander, I should say, because it wasn't even a grinder. It was,
yeah, not a grinder.
Yeah. And eventually, you know, finally, not even from selling knives, just I just saved enough money. This was still, you know, hobby time where I was like, okay, I'll get an actual grinder. I got a 2x42 grinder so I could at least get used to grinding on 2-inch belts. And these days there's a bunch of good grinder options. I know you didn't ask about grinders, but we're here. Like Grizzly has a 2x42 grinder that is variable speed and will flip horizontal for, I think it's like $395 or something like that. It's right at $400. And it may even be reversible. I can't remember, but it's ridiculous compared to the one I bought was straight vertical with a, you know, it's basically a bench grinder motor with a attachment over here with the belts on it. And over here, you got a disc. I'm sure y'all have seen them, and you turn it on and it runs 100 miles an hour, and it's like a 1/3 horsepower motor. You could bog down super easy, and definitely was not able to turn horizontal. Barely, the platen was concave. Barely had a work rest on it. It was, you know, so we're in a good time for this sort of equipment, I would say.
Yeah, I think you can definitely, without spending a whole bunch of money. And it's, you know, we might as well kind of dive into a little bit of the, you know, from the heat treat to, you know, the rest of it too, just getting started in this. And we both kind of talked about our, you know, how we got started and some of the stuff we've done, but I don't know if we've ever really spent a lot of time on, you know, kind of explaining what you can do or whatever. And, you know, cause I do think a lot of people, they feel like there's this big barrier to entry. Like you've got to go spend, you know, a few $1,000 or whatever to get started, but that's absolutely not true. Now, are you going to, it's just like anything else. Like you don't have to have, if you want to go learn to play golf, you don't have to go have the premium set of golf clubs, you know, when you first go out there. Like you just need something, you know what I mean? Like, of course we all want, you know, typically want the nice stuff, but that's, you got to be a little bit patient and, you know, if you got the money to spend on it, great. You know, and if you're confident enough that you're going to like it, then dive in. But, I would highly recommend, you know, doing, if you can maybe go and grind at somebody's shop or, you know, do what you're trying to do, at least try it, because it would really suck to spend a few $1,000 and then decide that you don't really like burning your hands that much and decide you're done. But, you know, yeah, a lot of people, the old thing used to be, you know, to, you know, buy a file, buy a piece of metal, you know, file it down, you know, make a knife out of it with a file and then buy another piece or whatever and keep building up. And I didn't start that low on the ladder. It never really appealed to me to like take a, I knew you could, but I just never really, I wanted to grind the knife. You know what I mean? Still stock removal, I know, but I wanted to put the steel to the wheel, like we say. So, yeah, I mean, I've told the story before, but I pieced together, I am so mad at myself that I don't have pictures and stuff of that grinder, but I pieced together a Franken grinder that's kind of similar to what Chase was describing, except homemade and way worse. And yeah, I mean, for very little money.
Did you sell it?
Very, very little money. No, I disassembled it. And I mean, there wasn't nothing, dude. I couldn't have sold that. Somebody would have like charged me to take that thing. It was horrible. But
I just didn't know what happened to it, you know.
It got disassembled, and you know, I guess the little bench grinder eventually burned up or something. The part that was, it was actual, I think mine was like maybe a quarter horsepower or something. It was not a big bench grinder. That was the, you know, the base of the thing. I don't know. I don't think it's one of the ones we still have. I'm assuming it burned up or something at some point, but no, I mean, it was like 4x6 cut off from one of the posts from building my shop. That was like the base for the upright, a piece of square tubing, or actually it may have been angle iron. I can't remember that. I don't know. I probably picked up. So I used to work construction, not when I wasn't working construction when I started making knives, but I had worked construction in the past, and I'm kind of a pack rat, and I had collected some pieces of angle iron and things like that out of the scrap piles at work over the years. And so I don't remember what all I used, but it was either a piece of square tubing or some angle iron. And I may have bought a couple of pieces like from Lowe's or whatever out of the little metal rack. I may have bought a couple of pieces of metal there. I truly don't remember, but yeah, plastic lawnmower wheel pressed onto the arbor of the little grinder there as a drive wheel. Like it was insane, but made hundreds of knives on it. So not going to say they were great, but they allowed me to progress. And I said, keep reinvesting the money I made from selling them into finally buying an actual grinder. So you can always find where there's a will, there's a way. That's 1,000,000% true. So while I don't necessarily recommend piecing together there's nothing wrong with piecing together a grinder, because a grinder, I mean, it's just like anything else. Like if you can build knives, technically you can probably build a grinder. You know, if you've got the mechanical ability to do this kind of stuff, then you know, if you put your mind to it, you can probably figure out a way. Even if you have to bolt everything together, if you don't have welding skills, which is what I did, everything was bolted and screwed together. If you don't have access to a welder or ability to weld, then I mean, there's ways to do it. So you can kind of look at how, like you said, there's tons of grinders out there. You could look and figure out a way to make something and probably do a much better job than I did and make something that would actually be decent without spending, you know. But at the same time, if you can go get that, like that Grizzly that you were describing for, what'd you say, like $400 or something?
Yeah.
Then, you know, unless you just happen, if you're like me and had a bunch of scrap stuff laying around that you could cobble something together, you might come out cheaper. But if you're trying to really build a, you know, a decent one, you'd probably end up spending more trying to build one than you would just going and buying that one. So, you know,
yeah,
there's options either way. So I'm trying to think what other kind, you know, the grinder is kind of the main piece of equipment. Drill press is, you know, that's not that big a deal, because you don't have to have a fancy, I mean, you can go to Harbor Freight and buy a drill press for what, like 40, 50 bucks for one of the little ones. Something like that. I mean, they're like
$80 now, but it's the same one. But yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, and no, they're not good. But I don't have a single really good drill press. Like you don't really need a fancy drill press to drill holes. You know. So
yeah.
It just doesn't take that much equipment and that much stuff to get started. Especially on fixed blades, you need a little more stuff. To do, you know, I've seen people get by with making folders without a mill and with nothing but a drill press and using it to cut the lock and everything else. It's definitely doable.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
I've seen people do some crazy stuff with Dremel tools and with, you know, like you said, on like, you know, chucking up a Dremel bit up in a drill press and just moving the thing back and forth. And
yep. Putting it in like,
I never had luck with it. Yeah, but
on that note, one of the things that made me think. Sorry, go ahead. It's our lag is getting us here, guys.
Yeah,
we're not just talking over each other.
I kind of picked up from you was, instead of having like one really good drill press, was having multiple drill presses. and I don't have as many as you had, like, but like, okay, this is my eighth inch, this is my quarter inch, this is my, you know, countersink, this is, you know, whatever, like having a sort of dedicated drill press, that way you're, you know, just, you know, kind of going down, the line and making it more efficient.
Yeah. And that's, I am really big on dedicated tools. I don't, typically to me, something that does multiple things, does a bunch of things okay, but none of them really great. I would rather have, you know, dedicated tools when I can. But, and for what you're describing, you know, for somebody that's like strictly a hobby maker, probably not that big a deal, you know, to take time to change out drill bits and stuff. If you're somebody that's, you know, like I was, or like Chase is, where you're trying to make a living doing it, you know, you need to be pretty efficient. So yeah, having a row of drill presses with the normal sizes of bits in there that you normally use, where you don't have to change them and you can just go down the line drilling your holes, is fantastic. So, and like you said, well worth the, and if you're doing it for a living or even as like a, you know, side hustle kind of thing, that's, it will, they will definitely pay for themselves probably within a month of, you know, of using them. So that is definitely a good idea.
For sure. One of the things I think, at least in the, you know, stock removal type world, as opposed to the forging world, is bandsaws. And, you know, you had like a really nice, like actual, like floor model bandsaw. I believe you still got
it. When you came along.
It was nice.
Go ahead, and then I'll tell how I got there.
Okay. Well, anyway, what I was going to say is, you know, now they have the port-a-band sort of situations where you can put them and chuck them up onto it, like where they stay permanently vertical, and you do it that way. That's what I run right now, is a Harbor Freight port-a-band, and then they've got like I think it's a Hercules is the brand, but it's from Harbor Freight as well. They've got a table that goes with it, and it's held up great. At first, the only table available was one from like Swag Off-Road, and it was more expensive than I wanted to spend on it. And so I built a little wooden table. I got some 2x4s, and I had a piece of like 2x10 or something like that I cut a slot into and just kind of mounted it up to it and drilled some holes and found some long bolts that were the right thread. I don't even think, you know, I just kept trying bolts out of my little tray until something worked. And, you know, that's what I used for a long time. And then eventually I upgraded to an actual, you know, something that's a little more square. So, but yeah.
Yeah. Bandsaw can be a little bit of a sticking point, but there's ways around it. Like you said, and even the one I got, it's not like a super nice bandsaw, but it's, you know, it is a floor, you know, an upright one or whatever. And it's, I had one of the vertical, well, the ones that are, can sit, lay down or like vertical or horizontal from Harbor Freight. Before that one, I didn't use it a whole lot because it sucked so bad. Part of that though was because at the time I did not know the difference between what kind of blades to use. I wasn't using the right kind of blades in it. So when I learned the right kind of blades to use, that helped a lot. But I don't think I learned that until I bought the upgraded bandsaw. But even before that, I cut out tons of knives with a angle grinder. I took the guard off an angle grinder. Now, I'm not recommending you do this. Like, this is, you know, do it at your own risk. But and you can do it with the guard on. It just makes it easier with the guard off. And I would clamp a piece. I would take my knife template. It was half the time. If I was being fancy, it was a piece of Kydex that I had cut out. If I was not being fancy, I was being cheap, it was a piece of an old plastic tote or something that I'd cut out the side of it with a pair of tin snips and made a knife template out of that. I'd lay it on there. I'd cut, trace it out with a magic marker. I would clamp it up. I'd take it outside, clamp it up like a sawhorse or a little table or something. And I would go to town cutting with that angle grinder, and I'd get it roughed out. And I could go in and kind of half cut and half grind because I was using cutoff blades, you know, not grinding blades. So I would cut it, and I got to where I was pretty good with it. I could cut stuff pretty close. Obviously, you can't do radiuses and stuff. You know, you can't make quite as clean of a radius and stuff as you can with a bandsaw. Even a bandsaw is not, you know, you're just getting close anyway. You're not cutting super tight radiuses and stuff. But so I'd cut them out like that, and then I'd take them to the grinder and finish just grinding them to shape from there. There's no telling how many knives I made doing that. I definitely do not recommend doing this, but when I started making folders before I had a bandsaw that I, again, you know, with the right kind of blade and all that, I even cut titanium with that thing. And that is definitely a nightmare. Yeah. You talk about throwing some sparks and nasty smells, and it would leave a huge, nasty kerf, like a big giant burr on the thing. Which I'd have to grind off on the grinder, belt grinder, which was not fun at all, and a whole bunch of extra time. But I did it until I could get a piece of equipment that I didn't have to do it. So I definitely do not recommend that for cutting titanium. You're probably way better off to do the setup that Chase talked about for all of it. But in a pinch, you can for sure cut stuff out especially if you're a hobby maker, and I'm thinking more towards like people making fixed blades and stuff, like you can 100% cut it out close enough with a angle grinder and a cutoff wheel, and then finish off profiling it on. You're going to finish profiling it on the grinder, whatever you cut it with, you know. Yeah. So it's just usually more to grind away when with a angle grinder cut. But yeah, you can 100% do it. That will get you by if you need to. Again, I don't, you know, proceed at your own risk. I will say this too. One thing I definitely would not ever do with an angle grinder and a cutoff wheel is to think that it's a smart idea to clamp it up in a vise and then cut it on and lock it. You know, you got the little button where you can lock the trigger on, so you're not having to hold the trigger down, and then try to use that like a saw. Definitely do not do that. I had some of the nastiest wounds I ever got doing this from that. It was nasty. Lucky I didn't lose a finger or two. And I mean, it was immediate too. And as soon as I did it, I was like, you dumbass. Like, why did you knew better than that. But I mean, as soon as I touched the wheel with it, like my fingers went right into it, right across my knuckles. And I was like, but anyway, and of course it left that grit and stuff from that wheel in there. It was, they weren't sure super deep or super bad, but they were nasty. Yeah. My Amy, you know, and her being the nurse that she is or was, whatever, like, she was definitely was not happy about that one. She's like, I think she probably called me a dumbass too.
Cause it's like a cut and a burn at the same time. Like I've cut myself on the side of belts like that. Like the edge of the belt will actually be able to cut you.
Oh yeah.
For those of you that don't know, especially like thin J-flex, like 220 J-flex belts, the edge of that belt, I mean, it's like a high speed paper cut basically.
Yeah.
With grit. Like with really sandpaper plus whatever, you know, steel or titanium or whatever else is now infused in that cut too. And it's burnt and it's cut and it stings and it's not fun.
And it's not like a clean cut with like a sharp edge, like a knife. It's like, it removes a hunk of, it cuts a groove down out of it. It doesn't just slice it and where it can kind of close back up. It's a big gaping. Yeah. Anyway, hope we don't have too many people with weak stomachs on here, but
For sure. But yeah, I've definitely done the angle grinder method too. I've got some S110V that I don't use a whole lot because my bandsaw will not cut it. I've tried multiple different blades of the Portaband blades, but it will not cut it. I don't know if it wasn't annealed right because it's all been the same sheet. I've been using the same sheet for a while, but any S110V knife that you've seen come out of my shop was cut out with an angle grinder. And I attempted to cut some titanium once. I can't remember why I did that. Maybe I was thinking it would be faster. Maybe I was out of bandsaw blades. I don't know why, but I did it. And then I immediately regretted it because of that kerf that you were talking about on the outside, like literally an inch or so of like basically like heat hardened titanium that's like flashed off the side and it's sort of like melted back into place. And it was a nightmare to get that off.
Yep. Yep. Definitely do not recommend that. I'd go buy the little portaband or something all day long before I did that. That's not real viable. You're fixed blade stuff, yeah. You know, cutting steel, you can absolutely get by with it, but I definitely do not recommend titanium.
When you were doing that, like for the angle grinder method for fixed blades and stuff, were you cutting handle material that way too? Or
no, I don't think I ever cut handle material that way. I'm trying to think how I cut it then. I may have been cutting it on that cheap Harbor Freight bandsaw. May have been the one thing that I was actually cutting on there. I honestly don't remember in the very beginning how I was. I wouldn't swear to it that I wasn't buying handle blanks, you know, that were, you know, when you
just scales.
You need to buy handling, yeah, like scales, and you know, which is it's an oversized blank, but I wouldn't swear to it that I didn't trace off the pattern on them and then just grind it all away on the grinder.
Seems,
I think I did some of that. I honestly don't remember for sure. I think you would burn the crap out of G10 and stuff if you tried to cut it with it, and it would definitely be nasty. I think I had to have either just ground it away on the grinder or maybe did some of them on the cheap bandsaw. I can't remember. I'm pretty sure I did some of both. Obviously, when we upgraded and got the better bandsaw, we did it on the bandsaw, but yeah
because I mean sheets are cheaper per, you know, like the suppliers have to do less processing to the
per
sheets
square inch,
so per square inch they're cheaper, so like if you're doing a lot of stuff and you're able to cut it, you know, sheets are better. But you know, if that's sort of a hang-up point, I would definitely say scales are, you know, probably preferable in that aspect. Did you have anything else you sort of wanted to talk about as far as like starting off on making or?
No, I think that I'm sure there's some other weird stuff that I did that was, you know, insane, but I can't think of anything. That covers most of the stuff, you know, drilling holes, cutting out stuff, you know, grinding the heat treat. That's just about everything that you do. The rest of it's other just, you know, hand tools and stuff like that. That's pretty basic stuff. So
one thing I had never even entered my brain to research or look at or anything like that until I entered your shop was making a sheath. I'd been trying to make fixed blades for a little while, but I was just make knife. That is idea. I couldn't formulate thought past that. It was just knife. But, you know, once I got to your shop and you were making Kydex sheaths for your fixed blades, I was like, oh, yeah, that should probably be a consideration. I never thought about that. And I mean, I think if you're selling fixed blade knives, you need to be able to provide a sheath to your customer. That's just my personal philosophy. Not hating on anybody out there that doesn't do that. I'm just saying, in my opinion, if you're selling someone a knife, it needs to be carryable, unless it's, you know, a $10,000 art dagger that you're going to hang up in a wall in a glass case. That's fine.
Yeah.
But it doesn't need a sheath. But, yeah.
And you can always Kydex get, like we do now. I mean, we outsource the sheaths to other, you know. When I say, I always cringe when I say outsource because I always feel like I need to qualify that with, you know, it's U.S. We're obviously not getting sheaths made in China or something, but, you know, it's other small, pretty small, you know, Kydex shop or whatever. But anyway, you know, you can do that. But, and I guess we could hit on real quick since you brought that up, the Kydex, was that probably where you were going with it? The Kydex press that we had, I guess when you started, was still my homemade one, I'm assuming, wasn't it?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think you got the new one whenever I was there.
Yeah, I believe you're right. So it's super simple, guys, and there's probably way better ways of doing it. And I've actually seen, I mean, I've seen guys use way better methods with just using a couple of pieces of you know, metal or even wood with foam on it, and put it in a vise and clamp it up, you know, the two sides, just make a sandwich with a vise to put it in there. But what I had done was I had two pieces of 2x12 or 2x10, and I had bought some, I think the foam that I bought was that the first that I got was I first used the pads for like sleeping bags, like camping, like the foam pads you buy to put you roll out, put your sleeping bag on. And then I finally wised up and like realized that I could just buy the foam from like a knife supply from Jantz or somewhere like that. I don't remember where I got it, but I bought some actual pieces of foam that were, you know, being sold for knife sheath making, and just glued a piece to each of those 2x10, and then used door hinges and fastened them together at the back. And back to that angle iron I was talking about that I scrapped off of a job site, I had a piece of it that was screwed down to the top 2x10. And then I guess we still were using probably a ratchet strap. The handle stuck out, so you had some leverage, and I had I may have put an eye hook, eye bolt or something in it out there. I can't remember. And then we had a ratchet strap that would go down to like a leg of the bench or whatever. And we'd put them in there, clamp them down, take that ratchet strap and tighten it down. And that would squish it down. And there's way better, you know, methods out there. Like I said, the two pieces of wood or aluminum or something with some foam glued on them in a 6-inch bench vise would have probably done way better and probably been easier. But that was, you know, I had seen sheath pressing things before, and you know, I basically was making a homemade version of what I had seen. I didn't even think about doing it with a vise or whatever, but yeah, that was another homemade rig that we used for years. So
even up until 2019, 2020, I guess, about the time we retired that.
Right in there.
I think it was in 2020 after I started working for you.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it was sometime not too long after you started that we bought the one we bought is just basically a better commercial version of the same thing. It's, you know.
Yeah.
And we use, even for it, we ditched the ratchet strap. It's kind of the same design, but we ditched the, it's kind of like a, you know, a waffle iron basically, you know, but with foam in it, kind of like it, that kind of construction, at least just a hinge thing on the back. And then we actually did put a chain on it and hooked it and have a, what do you call those, like toggle clamps? Is that what it's called, a toggle clamp?
I think so.
You have a hook on each end of it, and it's got like a toggle lever that you throw that it's like a cam action that it tightens it down and locks down. So you throw that and hope that you got it all the way down, because if you're not, it would pop back out and catch your knuckles if you're not careful. But anyway.
And scare the shit out of you too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It definitely would. But yeah, that was another little homemade deal that I forgot about. But yeah, so as you can see, guys, if you're, you know, hobby maker, or you're thinking about getting into it or whatever, there's so much information out there. Like you can probably find way better and, you know, do way better than even the stuff that I've just been describing. That's just how I muddled my way through it, and Chase too. So don't let feeling like there's a barrier to entry of equipment and tools and stuff like that. Don't let that stop you if you've got the itch to give it a try, because there's kind of no excuse not to go ahead and try it. There's just, it doesn't take that much.
Yeah. Yeah. If there's a will, there's a way. That's the saying. So don't get caught up too much on the methods. Just try to find a way to, you know, make it work, I guess. But yeah. And also on the fact of, real quick on Kydex is, you know, I still use a toaster oven to this day. One of the like cheap, came from, you know, Walmart or something, toaster oven that I got from a flea market or a yard sale or something. So doesn't have to be anything fancy. So you got anything else before we wrap this conversation up?
No, I think we'll probably wrap it on up. Hope you guys, this is Thanksgiving week, so we hope everybody has a fantastic Thanksgiving. I'll do a quick plug real quick. We're doing a promotion and doing a pretty big drop of some new stuff. cat's already out of the bag now, or one of the cats is out of the bag. We're dropping Shockwave Dixons on Friday, so that's brand new. And we've got a promotion going on with some free stuff with purchases and stuff like that. So you can go check that out on Instagram or our newsletter. And if you're not signed up for that, please fix that and get signed up for it. I'd appreciate it. And while we're on the asking for favors, appreciate if you guys could subscribe, if you could leave us a review, especially on the audio channels like on Spotify and Apple. If you could leave us a review, that definitely helps and lets us get a little bit more attention. And if you happen to want to get a hold of us and give us any suggestions, or if you've got questions, maybe we brought up some questions with all the stuff we talked about today, you can shoot us an email at where is that, Chase?
KnifeFreakShow@gmail.com with one S. KnifeFreakShow@gmail.com for questions, suggestions, knife stories, etc. Whatever you got.
Yep.
He is over at McNeeseKnives.com, McNeeseKnives on Instagram, McNeeseKnives on Facebook, Boatwright Blade Works on Instagram and Facebook, BoatwrightBladeWorks.wixsite.com. That's pretty much all I got.
All right. Have a good Thanksgiving, guys. We appreciate you listening and watching.
And let your freak flag fly.